Hi, this is Rod Faulkner, and you are listening to the 7thMatrix.com Eye on Sci-Fi podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 79 of the 7thMatrix.com Eye on Sci-Fi podcast, the podcast where we share with you terrific indie, science fiction, and fantasy online short films and web series, as well as conversations with fascinating filmmakers and other creatives. Thank you for listening. This episode features our conversation with filmmaker Aleem Hossein, who has just debuted his very first science fiction feature film entitled After We Leave. During our conversation, Aleem shares with us the plot of After We Leave, and he also goes into detail regarding the numerous powerful themes that the film touches on and why those themes are important to him. It was a very interesting conversation with an up-and-coming, talented, independent filmmaker. So without further ado, please enjoy the Eye on Sci-Fi podcast conversation with Aleem Hossein, the writer and director of the science fiction feature film, After We Leave. Aleem Hossein, good morning and welcome to the Eye on Sci-Fi podcast.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And we have you on to talk about your debut feature film. Is that correct?
That is true. It is my first feature.
Okay, it is called After We Leave, and I had the privilege of screening it beforehand. Thank you for that. I really enjoyed it. Would you please share what the premise of the film is?
So After We Leave is a near-future, gritty sci-fi drama. It's about a guy who he has this once-in-a-lifetime chance to emigrate off Earth, but only if he can find his estranged wife and convince her to come with him. The film is sort of set in this like near future Los Angeles where things are really bleak. There's like permanent recession and water rationing and crime. And 6 years ago, before he walked out on his wife, they had applied for a visa to immigrate to these off-world colonies where things are better. And he's back because the visa has come through, but he can't leave without her. It's a couple's visa because only married couples can go to the colonies to populate them.
Right.
So no one is happy to see him. But he is back. And the question of the movie really is he here because he genuinely wants to change and make things right with his wife? Or is he just back because he needs her for this lottery ticket to a better life?
That's what I found fascinating when I watched the film, is that he is going through this personal odyssey of redemption and seeking a better life for himself. But as you follow him, you see the devastation that he left behind when he literally just walked out, not only on his wife, but his friends and his associates 6 years previous.
Yeah, this is a story about a person whose decisions in the past had a pretty big impact on a lot of other people. And really, I see the film partially as me exploring the extent to which second chances are possible. When I was imagining the film, the first image that came to me was an image without a story. It was just of a man's face looking. I just was sitting in traffic in Wilshire Boulevard, and I had this image of this guy, and he had a look on his face. And for some reason, I knew in that sort of weird creative way, like, oh, he's looking at his wife who he hasn't seen in a while. And the question on his face is, has he changed? That's the question in his mind and in our minds. And I didn't know what that fully meant, but it started me on a journey of thinking about how much do we really change? And, in movies, when I started writing it, I realized in some ways I'm frustrated with, as much as I love some of these movies, I'm also frustrated with depictions of very flawed men, especially white men, who they're very flawed, but somehow they achieve this huge amount of personal change and they get everything they wanted in the end.
Right.
And I honestly wanted to have a discussion with that plot. I think that describes, on the one hand, some of the greatest movies ever made, but also I think there's some problems with it. And it just didn't resonate with me on a personal level. It wasn't even necessarily that I started from a political angle. I just felt like, I don't know if that's true. And so this is a movie to try explore realistically, well, to what extent can you change? And what does the struggle to change look like? And what do you get from it?
You know, that's something, too, that resonated with me, and I'm glad that you brought that up about that Hollywood trope of the ne'er-do-well or the anti-hero, but he really has a heart of gold.
Yes.
And as you say, everything works out for this particular person at the end. But in your movie, the main protagonist, Jack Chancy, he's not a good person. And you still see that in the way that even though he returns after this absence, the way that he treats people, he uses them as a means to an end, which is to try to find out where his wife is. And your cast is extraordinary. I love the performances.
I feel very proud of the work they did and very humbled, honestly, of the work that those actors did with me. Getting good performances is something that's very important to me as a director. And the truth is, I think the reason that we, you know, especially in independent film, you don't see it a lot, or you see it relatively, you know, less sometimes, is that it is hard under the circumstances of a low-budget movie where you often have to move quickly. You don't have resources to hire obvious name actors whose talent we already know. You know, there are a lot of barriers to that, but it's something that I care very much about. And so I'm glad to hear you say that. It really makes me feel good.
Well, I'm glad. Well, definitely I commend you and your cast because, again, the performances were exceptional. My favorite character, though, the person whose voice really resonated with me was that of Faith. And I believe she was portrayed by Naomi Salomon. Is that correct?
Yes.
She was incredible. And what I loved about her interaction, her character Faith, when she interacted with Jack, is that she calls him out on his good fortune and that it is an extension of the privilege that our society extends to certain individuals. It's not based on merit. Could you elaborate more on that?
I mean, you have hit the nail on the head. It's absolutely what I was thinking about when I wrote the character and then when I sat down with Naomi. You know, I had a very open casting process in this film. We were shooting sort of, you know, incrementally, and I wanted to work with actors that I either had worked with a lot beforehand, and my lead actor, for example, I'd worked with for years and years, but Naomi was a friend of that. So Brian Silverman's the lead, and she was a friend and sort of acting, you know, cohort partner of his. And I knew, first of all, to get to the point you just said, I knew that that role wasn't going to be someone, it wasn't going to be a white character. She's, you know, half Korean, half white. And I knew it was going to be a woman because I feel like those two positions of like being a woman character and being someone who wasn't not, you know, wasn't 100% white, like that's the character that I know as someone who's a mixed race myself. In my head, I call out that kind of privilege a lot. But we don't see it called out loud in the world or in movies that much.
Exactly.
And yeah, for me, she really represented, you know, so often in movies, we focus on characters of extreme. They're extremely good, extremely bad, extremely determined. And to me, she's the kind of person who has her head down. She's trying to live a good life and be a good person in this future world. And she's not rewarded for it, you know?
Right.
You know, and honestly, even in my movie, she's not the main character, right? The movie's not about her. But I thought of her as a voice of, yeah, a more sort of grounded human being just trying to sort of get through the world morally, thoughtfully, you know, and with purpose, but not in some grandiose quest. But also, I didn't want to cast her aside. I felt like she's a character. She can speak some of the things that I feel about these narratives. And again, I think like it's one thing to think that as an idea, but people will feel that, you know, 1,000 miles away in a movie. It's like, oh, here's the clunky speech about privilege. And so one of the things that I loved about working with Naomi was like, I didn't actually need to say any of that out loud. Like she read that character and she knew why that character was angry. She knew why that character was disappointed. And so she embodied the idea that I had beforehand. And whenever it gets embodied in a character, that's when it resonates. Because it just feels like, yeah, that's a real person. That's what she really feels.
I agree. And everything felt organic. It no point during the film that I feel as though I were being preached to or that the characters were in a soapbox, but it really, truly, their reactions felt natural and visceral. And that read very well on screen, especially her reaction and her responses to Jack's return. You know, her husband was his best friend. And even though you could tell that he felt ambivalent about Jack returning, you know, he was his best friend. So yeah. He still kind of welcomed him. So I love the fact that she was there to kind of give Jack a reality check and to express her frustration, because again, as you say, she and her husband are good people. They probably merited those visas. Yeah. They had applied 2 years before Jack did, but they still have to try and carve out a future on the planet. And as you stated earlier, things have gone to hell in a handbasket on planet Earth. And that's something else too that I wanted to ask you about, because I love the way that you subtly weave in that the planet is really in a dire state, definitely with climate change and all of these pressing issues that we're dealing with now. I really appreciate how you were able to weave that in.
Thank you. I mean, I think that is something that I think took some effort and for me, like I never wanted like there to be a scene where you're like, oh, well, this is the shot where what he's telling us is climate change is real. You know, like what I really wanted to do was make the film, the world of the film, feel like it felt to those characters. So the reason it's weaved into the background, the reason it's subtly there is that's the presence of this world in their lives. You know, I really thought of this movie as I wanted to make the movie as if even we, the filmmakers, were living in that particular year in the future.
Right.
And so we weren't, you know, going to like, when there was an amazing touchscreen computer or a rocket taking off, you won't see this like worshipful VFX fetish shot, because I kind of imagined that imaginary filmmaker in the future is also, you know, the guy holding the camera is like, yeah, yeah, rocket, you know, like,
right.
And also like I wanted to sort of express it of a weariness of like, yeah, the world, there's not enough water. The climate is in terrible shape. There's rising crime. Society's not quite working, you know? I wanted all of those things to have a reality to them. And I think honestly what gives them a reality is when you feel like, yes, these characters have been living with this for years. And so their reactions to it, the way they feel about it, and then even I as a filmmaker, the way I shot it, was to get that point across.
Well, I think that you succeeded in that. And I want to go back to your cast and talk about your leading man, Brian Silverman. He did a terrific job, because the character, even though he's dark and he's not, quote unquote, that likable, but you still kind of feel a sort of empathy for him, because you feel that he is trying to, the best he can, make change, and it's not quite working. Was Brian always your first choice? Did he have to audition? Because you did mention that you had worked with him many years before. How did his involvement come about?
Brian, I could talk about Brian all day. He's just an amazing, amazing artist. And yes, we had worked together. So I knew from the very beginning this movie was going to be about him. And I knew he was going to be in the role. And I knew that for two reasons. One, just when the character occurred to me, I knew it was him. But honestly, second, when I was even just setting out to make a low-budget science fiction movie that I knew I was going to shoot somewhat incrementally over time to avoid the pressures of like a sprint, really quick indie shoots, that I'd have time to work on the performances and story and visuals, I knew I needed someone who was like 120% committed to me and to working with me. And he and I just have an amazing collaboration. I knew that he would dive in just as much as I did. So that was already there. And then when I thought of the character, I was like, oh, this is definitely him. And, you know, Brian, he brought so much to the movie. He's the one who had to sort of, you know, get in there and figure out like, what is Jack actually thinking? How do you portray someone who we as outside viewers might think, no, man, that's a mistake, or, oh, gosh, that's the wrong thing to say. Like, how do you authentically portray someone who has some blind spots,
right,
but also who's trying? And again, that idea of, like, I think so often in Hollywood, our language of, is a character likable? I mean, as you, I think, also are implying with the way you said it, like, I think we obsess too much over a character being likable. I think right. What we should ask ourselves is a character interesting to watch and compelling to travel with and go along with? But yeah, I mean, he's the one who had to, you know, he and I together really had to figure out this idea of how do you portray a person who is struggling, who is trying, who is having some forward momentum and some backward momentum, and have that all be like very true to them, that they think they're doing the best. I mean, I think for most of the movie, he thinks he's better than he is, you know, and to portray that not as some form of like stupidity, but more like that's human beings, you know, like I think we all in some ways, like, you know, our vision of ourselves in our head and who we are at different points in our lives, they're closer or farther apart. You know what I mean? And
right.
And he's at this point where he is trying to change. And I think he is not the person he used to be. But I don't know that he's also the person he thinks he's become.
Right. He's not as far along on that continuum as what he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, too, your antagonist in the piece, Eric, was also very compelling because for me personally, I believe that the antagonist of a piece can make or break the entire work.
Absolutely.
And he is written, again, as with all the characters in the movie, with such nuance because you could easily go into caricature and kind of have a mustache twirling
Yes.
antagonist. And your actor, and I know that that was also due in part the collaboration between your direction, the script, and the actor, but Clay Wilcox was terrific as Eric. And I love how he's kind of the antithesis of Jack in a way, but then in a way, they're kind of like the yin and the yang, because Jack has this primary agenda, which is to find his wife. And you think when he encounters Eric that Eric has this primary agenda of Jack repaying him. And I'm not going to spoil it, but there's another agenda that's directly underneath that's not revealed until later in the third act. And I loved how you wove that throughout the film. Could you speak on Eric's journey?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, like you say, a lot of credit to Clay Wilcox, another actor who I've worked with a lot in the past. Clay is very frequently telling me, "Hey, Aleem, someday can I be a nice guy?" And the funny thing is that in real life, Clay is one of the like sort of like nicest, sweetest, most sort of like sensitive people that I know, which is what makes him a good actor. You know,
right.
He's very in touch with his emotions and his feelings. But I keep casting him as the bad guy. But I put bad guy in quotes along the lines of what you just said. I think like it is really important to me that the antagonist in a film, you know, is not just this sort of mustache twirly thing, like you said. And Clay, I think he's so good at being a real person. You know, he's the kind of actor who does the work. Like if he does have to have the scene where he's telling someone that he might kill them, he's done the work to think about what it really feels like as a human being to say that to another human being and what might lead you to do that. And then on top of it, like, you know, it was very important to me that the antagonist be someone who the main character Jack knew personally. The whole movie is about him coming back trying to find his wife and make things right with her. But also, as you pointed out in the beginning, he's also, you know, sort of blew up a lot of his other relationships. And so I wanted it also to be a movie about, you know, a betrayal of a friendship and the kind of sort of reaction that can create. And that's why the plot does interweave in that way at the end, as you sort of, you know, alluded to, that this is a man, you know, this character, Eric, who's the antagonist. He was betrayed in his own way, he feels, by Jack. And he has his own feelings about that and how he's going to deal with them. And that's, I think, what makes a good antagonist. His goal in life is not to do evil. What's happening, I don't even know if he has a goal, because honestly, he's just hurt. And he expresses that hurt in a different way, given the kind of person that he is.
Right. Right. And I would say, too, Aleem, that, well, the way that I perceived it when I watched your film is that really the goal of everyone in the film is to survive.
Yes. And I think when you are living in a world where you actually have to think about that, where survival is your primary concern, it warps everything. You know,
yes.
You can see that in life, right? Like, you know, in so many ways, like when people, you know, are growing up in poverty, when people are displaced from the country they live in or live in a war zone, when kids live in a family, you know, where things are not peaceful, like, you know, like anyways, anytime you see any human being who is pushed into that destabilized fight or flight, like, oh, my survival is at stake. When you live in that long term, it warps you. It affects you, you know, and I would actually be pretty interested to explore like a future where enough of the world is in trouble that that's actually the state of affairs for almost everyone.
Yes. Another scene that really touched me was when Jack is in the administrative office trying to get an extension on his visa. And he doesn't succeed. That doesn't bear any fruit for him. And he goes into the bathroom and he's confronted by that couple. and you see the desperation. And for some reason, that really did struck a chord with me, because in this world, it now really doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is, you know, what your background is in terms of surviving on Earth. It's pretty much just, as you say, people trying to carve out a life, and they may have to go to extremes that they never thought that they would.
Yeah, that scene was, I think, maybe the second or third scene that I wrote in the script. Like, as soon as I knew that the story was going to be about, partially about this idea of visa quotas, and I knew that I was going to tell it from an American point of view. You know, some of the story is inspired by, you know, I'm a mixed race American. Like, my father is an immigrant from, a Muslim immigrant from Bangladesh. My mom is a, like, Roman Catholic Spanish Italian woman from Connecticut. But when I listen to the stories that my Bangladeshi relatives tell about applying for these visas to go from one of the poorest countries on Earth to come to one of the richest countries on Earth, and, you know, waiting years to find out, and what, you know, just hearing about that made me realize, like, you know, that when you have, like, this life-altering lottery, it pushes people again to extremes, and it's hugely disruptive. And so I wanted to put it in an American context, partially because I do think that, look, I think our future is that the problems of, you know, of the global south, of these sort of developing countries, are going to be the problems of the world, and climate change and financial instability, and all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, I wanted to have, I knew I was going to just tell the audience right away, look, here comes a quote unquote nice looking white couple, and they are desperate for a visa and willing to do things that they probably in normal life would not have been willing to do. And to me, that was, again, sort of a message of, this is what this movie is. You know, this is what the world of this film is.
And it really is impactful. And speaking of the lottery system that is in place, of course, the lottery promises to be totally random, which, of course, it is not. And only certain people who pretty much already have privilege in society are the first ones who are chosen. What struck me about that was how prescient that felt. And also, too, it is a cautionary tale because, of course, there's a lot of excitement right now about us exploring Mars and planning a manned expedition to Mars and what our future will be, in that we want to eventually leave the planet. But what I thought you brilliantly brought out is that if we don't really take a close look at our collective consciousness and, you know, exactly the problems and the social ills, the societal ills that we're dealing with, we'll just take that legacy with us to the stars or wherever else we may eventually go. Was that part of your thinking when you created that part of the script?
So, Rod, is there any chance that you stole my brainstorming notebook and are reading directly from it?
No, Aleem, I'm just a great big blurred, okay?
Yeah. No, honestly, like, that really, that exact thought was so much on my mind. And it was really stemming from me thinking about the internet and the sort of digital revolution and the way in which that represented a frontier full of optimism and change, but that has not been equitably distributed, you know?
Exactly.
And so I wanted to transpose that to sort of, you know, yeah, to the stars. And I also, you know, it's so funny. I started brainstorming the story for this idea during the Obama administration. And I literally had, you know, some people gave me notes in the script say, why so pessimistic about, are we really going to have race and class differences in visas? Come on, like, what's the, imagine a different future. And they weren't even necessarily pressing me to be more optimistic. I think they were kind of like, those are old concerns. What are some new sci-fi concerns? And then what's ironic is the film has not gotten less relevant in the time that I eventually then got to shoot it, and the election of Trump and the sort of just overall, like, global political climate. Now I feel like, oh my God, I think I might be more pessimistic and more sort of dark if I were to project the future now. So weirdly, like, the world sort of caught up to my sort of thinking, which I wish wasn't true, but sadly is.
Yeah, I mean, your film feels really, really, it's almost eerily prescient because it's near future, and I love the way that you frame it, that it's recognizable, but there are touches in the movie that show that, no, this is in the far future, not too far, but, you know, we have interstellar travel capability, and I love the way that you show the advances in, I guess you would call them smartphone technology, but just those little touches indicate that, no, this is the future. But like you, I've gotten a lot more pessimistic since the last presidential election. And I remember, this was just the other day, I saw where this company is building, literally, they're planning to build a hotel in space that orbits the Earth. And I was just looking at all the conversation that was going on in the forums underneath the article about this space hotel. My first thought was, who's going to be able to afford that?
Yeah, and I think that, like, that is, I think that's one of the reasons that it's important for lots of different kinds of people to make sci-fi.
Yes.
When we sit down and imagine the future, the truth is, this wasn't a wild stab in the dark that happened to be prescient, right? What I was drawing on were feelings that I was having inside, being like, look, I do hope that the arc of the arc of the universe is long and bends towards justice. I hope that's true. But for sure, even during more optimistic times, if you ask me deep down inside as a person of color, you know, like, I would tell you, I still have anxieties. I still have fears and difficulties and struggles, you know? And I was drawing on them to imagine the future. And so in the same way, I think everyone has this point of view. I heard a great interview the other day. I'm going to forget who it was. It was a science fiction author, though, and he was talking about how when he watched Star Wars, one of the first things he thought was, he was a Latino author, and he said something like, when I saw the Millennium Falcon, I thought, if my people were in this movie, we're the ones fixing that ship when it goes into the shop.
Right.
You know, and where's that story?
Right.
And I think that's sort of a pretty easy to understand idea. But like, if you expand that out, it really is true that, like, you know, when we think about, I mean, honestly, any kind of story, obviously, but in particular, a speculative story. And I think the best sci-fi and fantasy stories are actually drawing from a true, like, what if kind of questioning, or a true, well, let's explore this to its, you know, extreme end or imaginative end kind of questioning. The identity of the person, their experience, that will be there. And when different people do that, you come up with different answers that are, I think, pretty interesting.
I would wholeheartedly agree. I'm African American, so I definitely understand, you know, the feelings of anxiety that you just described, and also a frustration too, because I've loved speculative genres since I was itty bitty.
Yeah, me too.
And one of the things, of course, being people of color, that we inwardly always know is that we rarely are seen in those stories. I mean, even you mentioned Star Wars, but Episode 9 will finally have a Black woman on screen. And I think out of all the movies that have comprised that franchise, it's still kind of sad that this will be the first appearance of an on-screen. I know Lupita Nyong'o was in A Force Awakens, but she was in a CGI-created role for that character. She wasn't flesh and blood on screen. And again, we need to have speculative stories, as you say, told from diverse perspectives. That's one of the reasons why I created The Seventh Matrix, because I found that in the independent film space, these stories are being told just like your film. Your film feels real, not only because of the emotionally intelligent script, but you have an inclusive cast that reflects the world that we live in. It's not part of an quote-unquote agenda. And always when I hear that, when it comes to inclusivity, oh, they're just trying to foster an agenda. Don't you think that having movies and television series that are homogenous and all white is not fostering an agenda? So yeah.
I don't know if you find this, but I definitely find too, it's like, it is possible for, you know, people like you and I to both love Star Wars and to be disappointed by that thing. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
And that gets lost, I think, in the conversation. And then, like you say, like, when I think about, I'm glad you mentioned the overall diversity of my cast. Like, and I would say, like, as a creator, you know, if you watch the movie, I have thought very carefully about for each level of society, each kind of job, each financial position that a character is in, I thought carefully about the demographics as a, like, well, because again, I'm predicting society or I'm exploring my speculative idea. And so every one of those roles is not cast randomly. You know, it is a statement on my part about where I think society and stratification and institutional racism are headed.
Right. Right. And again, that's what helps give your film a real sense of verisimilitude that many other post-apocalyptic projects kind of fail to nail and even bother to address. Also, I don't want you to get away from me before we discuss the conclusion of the film. And again, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but it was powerful. And you pulled a fast one because it didn't end the way that I thought. And the ending was brilliant, it was unexpected, and it was really fitting for the character. So what I want to ask, was that the original ending? Was that always intended, or how did that come about? Because it was beautiful.
So when I first had the initial sort of inspirational images for the movie, I didn't know that ending. But when I sat down to write the story, I tapped into a couple of things. The first one was the thing I think I mentioned earlier, where I knew I was dissatisfied with a certain kind of traditional storytelling and where it leads. But really, I just asked myself questions about that character, about this guy, Jack, and who I thought he really was and what he was capable of and what he wasn't. Right. And what I thought the world would give him in return for what he does, you know, and you know, the ending is the part of the movie that I think, honestly, I'm happiest with. You know, as a filmmaker, I think you're always trying to outdo yourself and do better each time. And but yeah, there's a point in the ending there that I think I am pleased, at least with that. I think I did communicate my personal feelings, and I mean that in a real, like, emotional way, not a political, like, my real, like, feelings about what it means to be a human being. And what our actions sort of do, and what is possible and what is not possible. And the thing I love about that ending too is that it's a real testament to my collaborators. Like, you know, I think the ending works partially because Julie Kirkwood, my cinematographer, is just, she's a visual genius, you know, and I spoke to her so in depth about what I wanted that ending to feel like, and those shots make a difference. And my composer, Shonda Dancy, you know, again, like, she wrote that piece of score, and if there's anything in the movie that I would say it's exactly as I wanted it to be, 100%, every single, you know, percentage of it, it would be that ending piece of music. I think that the thing she wrote for that also really sells that. And so it's a wonderful thing to me, like, to be satisfied with the story. But honestly, I love, it's this moment in the movie with between the performances of the actors and my cinematographer and my editor and my editor Lori Lavoie-Garon and my composer, like, all of them coming together. Off of an idea that I pitched them that I knew wasn't a typical ending. And they all just instantly got it and got on board with it. And I think that's why it works.
It does work. And also, I want to bring up, too, that the budget for your film was around $30,000. Is that correct?
That is. And, you know, we shot the movie for about, we got it sort of, quote unquote, in the can for about $12,000. And then I did a Kickstarter to raise the rest for post-production. And you may have seen elsewhere, but, you know, I hesitated at first to sort of say that number out loud, just because some people gave me the advice of, look, the movie does not look like a $30,000 movie, so why say it? Like, why make audiences think it's a cheap movie when it's not? But the reason that I've been saying it is not to brag, like, oh, wow, look what I did. Look how amazing it is that I made this for $30,000. I've been saying it and talking about it because I want people to know that you can make a science fiction film, and by the way, not, you know, particularly like mainstream commercial film, but like I think it's a gritty film asking tough questions.
Yes.
I think it's, you know, like, it's my attempt to make a piece of cinematic art. And we did it, you know, $12,000 to get into post-production, and then some Kickstarter money to finish post, you know, under 30 grand. Still, that's a lot of money, but that's so much less money than, you know, like the catering budget for a day on the Avengers. Right. And so, again, my message of, like, if you were someone out there who thinks that sci-fi doesn't want you or is not for you or is not something you can achieve, my message is you can. It is still hard. I don't want to say that, give the impression that it's easier, that I, you know, but it is a genre that is so important in terms of what it can say and what it can do. It's so fun to work in as a filmmaker, and it is possible now to do it cheaply. And so I think that does mean that, you know, if you're the kind of filmmaker, you just have a point of view or a quirky view of the world that you don't see expressed, go make your own science fiction film. Are you a woman filmmaker, a person of color filmmaker who, you know, feels shut out from sci-fi? Go try and make your own sci-fi film. You know, I do think that we should take ownership. And by we, I really mean not just, you know, some sort of demographic diversity mission, but just like anyone who feels like they're not seeing the kind of sci-fi they want to see should feel ownership to be a part of the conversation of sci-fi.
That is fantastic. And I know that that's going to encourage a lot of our listeners, because we have a lot of independent filmmakers and aspiring independent filmmakers who listen to our show and also read The Seventh Matrix. And I know that just do it, just no matter what, if you have a burning desire to be a filmmaker and to create stories that you're not getting, then it's a great time now to go ahead and jump in and take that plunge. And your film definitely is further proof of that, because right now we're being fed a steady diet mainstream of visual and special effects bonanzas, and it's nothing wrong with that, but again, it is becoming more the norm than not. And we do need more science fiction that focuses on the big questions, because that's what speculative genres do best, is ask what if and make us stop and reflect on the human condition. And your film definitely accomplishes all that in spades. From what I understand, it's already gaining a lot of notice. It won Best Feature at Sci-Fi London. Is that correct?
That is, you know, and
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that's one of those moments where, you know, again, to sort of also speak about the journey, like, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs in making the movie. Like, I managed to scrape together the money to make the movie. It was such a sort of long haul, very rewarding one, but a really long haul to get it finished. And then I got rejected from like 20, 25 festivals in a row. And I was basically about to sort of give up on the festival route when I got this email from Sci-Fi London. And the best thing with this email was, the email was written as if they were assuming that I was just choosing between many, many festivals. You know, they were like, look, we want to make a pitch to you. We are a smaller festival, but we love sci-fi. You know, we launched the, the career of Gareth Edwards, you know, like give us a chance. Would you consider us? And of course I read the email and was like, yes, please. Like, cause I didn't have any other festivals. I'd been rejected by like 20 or 25 of them. And then wow. I got there and then I won the festival. And you know, like this crazy world of independent film where there can be 20 places that didn't even want to screen me. And then in the next place, not only screened my film, but gave me the Best Feature Film Award. It's a crazy world, you know? And then that winning that award has been great. It's definitely launched a bunch of other festivals that I have coming up, including I'm going to have my North American premiere in Austin in December at Other Worlds. Okay. I mean, I'm going to be Berlin Sci-Fi and Boston Sci-Fi. But the big thing is that it has gotten distributors interested. And so I'm very, very close to closing a distribution deal for worldwide distribution. And to think like that that's possible, given, you know, where I started the film with, you know, basically no budget and no famous actors or anything like that, is pretty terrific.
Wow, that's just an inspiring and wonderful account, Aleem. And look, your film and yourself, your production team, all deserve all the awards, because it is truly a wonderful piece of work. Where can our listeners go online to find out more about After We Leave, such as when it will be available for public exhibition, and also what projects you're working on?
So the place to go, you can go to afterweleave.com. I have a newsletter there that sort of functions both as the way that I update people about my projects. It's also a newsletter where I send out a few little sort of emails every year about my sort of take and my likes in independent sci-fi and diversity in genre films in general.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Sort of a two-for-one there. People can sign up for the newsletter. And then also I'm on Twitter at Aleem, A-L-E-E-M. And I'm on Instagram. It's my full name, Aleem Hossein. But if you go to After We Leave, you can find afterweleave.com. You can find it all there. And I think that, you know, that's where we should be, like, seeking out, like, independent creators on Instagram, on Twitter, you know, at their newsletters. I just want to stress to people, and I say it not just for myself, but for all the creators out there, it's actually not just morale boosting to have someone follow you on social media or sign up for your newsletter. When I talk to distributors, they're literally asking those questions. How many people get your newsletter? How many people follow you on Twitter? So you're actually, as a fan or supporter of sci-fi, when you follow your, not just like their tweets, when you follow a creator you like, you know, right, I think these days you are actually helping them make that next film.
Wow. That's good to know. Thank you for sharing that. And Elaine, it has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you stopping by to take time to just share with us, you know, your process and the inspiration for After We Leave. And we're definitely going to be looking forward to seeing it when it's available to the public. And of course, I'm also going to be including a link to afterweleave.com so that our listeners can go to find out more about you. And everyone, definitely sign up for that newsletter. That sounds great. I know I'm going to. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rod. Yeah, and I think the film will be out probably in January, will be available for pre-sale. But I wanted to say to you, I really enjoyed this conversation and the kinds of questions you asked about the film. I think so often these kind of conversations just focus on what camera did we shoot on or how many days, and like, you know, I am interested in that stuff. But to be honest, like, just the things you just asked me about, they mean a lot to me because they're at the heart of why I made the film. And it's just really nice to encounter people who, you know, see the film and think about it that way. So thank you so much.
Oh, no, my pleasure. My pleasure, Aleem. And again, I appreciate you and I wish you all the best. I know we're going to be seeing and hearing a lot about this film. I would definitely place a bet on that. So I'm excited for you and wish you all the best.
Thank you.
And there you have it. The Eye on Sci-Fi podcast conversation with Aleem Hossein, the writer and director of the science fiction feature film After We Leave. I will be including a link to Aleem's website in the show notes of this episode. Just visit theseventhmatrix.com and navigate to podcast, or use the direct link, theseventhmatrix.com/EOSF podcast, to access not only the show notes of this episode, but an archive of show notes from all of our previous episodes as well. Hey everyone, Rod Faulkner here, and before I sign off, I needed to ask your help. Ever since the7thmatrix.com came online in 2013, we have been sharing terrific indie science fiction and fantasy online short films and web series on the site ad-free. However, in order to continue our work, we need your help. If you would, please visit theseventhmatrix.com/support in order to learn all of the ways in which you can help us continue to do the work that we do. You can make a donation via our PayPal button, become a monthly supporter via Gumroad, or purchase our Science Fiction and Fantasy Short Film Guide that contains over 30 hours of outstanding indie science fiction and fantasy short films. Or you can choose to support one of the Eye on Sci-Fi podcast sponsors. But either way, your support is vital to us, and we thank you. And that is it for this episode of the7thmatrix.com Eye on Sci-Fi podcast. Thank you again for listening. Please subscribe to us via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play Music, or wherever you're listening. And if you're listening via Apple Podcasts, leave us a review and rating. That really helps others find us, and I really appreciate that too. Visit the7thmatrix.com to check out all the sensational indie science fiction and fantasy short films and web series we have curated and collected there. Sign up for our newsletter so that our latest discoveries will be sent directly into your inbox. So, until next episode, everyone, remember, take a break, escape the mundane, and enter the fantastic. Take care.